Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We are still in the Gospel of Thomas. We'll be starting with saying 29 in just a couple minutes. And so I beg your patience as people enter the chat room and we will get started.
Hi, how you doing? Can you hear me? I can't hear you.
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, thank you. How are you feeling?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Hopefully no migraines this...
Not this week. Hey,
so
Doctor, how you doing?
Good.
Hi, Grace and Grace's friends.
Good morning. Yeah, this is Cherise. She's joining us today.
Good morning.
Hi, Cherise. Good morning.
But I can't get us both in here. I got pulled. There we go. There we are.
That's better.
Hi, Reverend Sarah.
Very nice to meet you, Cherise.
And this is Donna. That's Jeanette.
Good to meet you.
Hi, Donna. Hi, Jeanette.
We're going to give just one more minute to let people come into the meeting, and then we will get started, and we're going to be starting on saying 29 of the Gospel of Thomas. Slowly, we chug our way through.
You think we'll never get to, 114?
Eventually.
Are we going to continue through the summer?
Yes, I have no problem with that if you guys don't. I will be gone for 2 weeks of vacation, but I'll let you know when that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I would like to continue through summer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoy it.
Okay. Donna, will you say something and test your sound? Nope, can't hear you. You're not muted, Donna. You're not muted in the Zoom application in that software, but you may have turned your computer's microphone off. Nope, still can't hear you. If this persists, what you might do is log out of the meeting and then log back into the meeting and then connect with your phone for audio. Because it can ask you, do you want to use your computer for audio? And you can say, no. And you can connect with your phone because we still can't hear you. Good morning, Marilyn. How you doing?
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
Marilyn, Grace's friend Cerise is joining us today. And so I'm not sure where Sue is, but we're going to get started and she may jump in a little bit later.
Okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and read saying 29, and we'll have just a couple of moments of silence afterwards as we let it sink in and give the introverts time to think about things. Yeshua said, "If flesh came into being because of spirit, it is a wonder. But if spirit came into being because of flesh, It is a wonder of wonders. Yet the greatest wonder is this. How is it that this being, which is, inhabits this nothingness? Let's let that sink in for just a moment or two of silence before we begin our discussion.
Could you direct me to the one you're reading?
Number 29.
Thank you.
And that ding, that means someone's dialing in.
All right. What jumps out at you in saying 29?
Saying this, it seems kind of weird that he would say, I wonder how this came about. I mean, he's all knowing, correct?
Why don't you start that again? Because we only heard a portion of what you were talking about, but I'm trying to do something on my end to focus the audio on you. So try that one more time.
Okay. Have the very last sentence says but as for me, I wonder at this, how this great wealth made its home in this poverty. And if Jesus is saying that, it just seems very strange to me, because he is all knowing, and why would he say something like that? You know, I but as for me, I wonder at how this came about, you know.
Okay. All right, what do you think about that? She's asking about the last line. In my version, it says, how is it that this being which is inhabits this nothingness? In her version, it's this poverty. What do you guys think about that? This is a fun and tricky one.
Well, are they talking about poverty not being in the spirit?
That's a good question. That's a good question. What do you guys think?
What did she say?
She said, are you talking about poverty being not the spirit, or poverty of the spirit?
I assume poverty was the body and the wealth was the spirit. You know, it says this great wealth made its home in this poverty. So it would be this great wealth, namely the spirit, and how it made its home in this body. Mm-hmm.
So, does anyone else have thoughts about this? Okay, we know what part that you've got your spotlight on. Does anyone else have thoughts about this? Marilyn?
Is that questioning the creation and who created what? You know, I mean, God always was, and we think of God as the spirit, and you want to create a body, go ahead, he did, you know. But if the body was already there, it changes it all around. And I don't.
Okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. Sue, do you want to weigh in on this?
I feel both confused and not confused.
Okay.
I don't have anything really to add to the confusion.
Okay. Well, so there's definitely at least one or two things going on here. And the joy of there being at least one or two things going on here is that we've got a saying with multiple meanings. And so whatever level on which you want to meet the text, it will have a meaning for you. So if you can only bear to like dig down just beneath the topsoil, and that's your level, it has a meaning for you. If you want to dig down deep and like excavate dinosaur bones, it'll have a meaning for you at that level too. So multiple meanings, they're all valid. Another thing to consider is that in the Gospels, and very, very clearly in the Gospel of Thomas, like in the canonical four Gospels, but then also in the Gospel of Thomas, we see Jesus using some Greek thought. And by Greek thought, I mean the Greeks pioneered philosophy so far as we understand it, given the written record of history. Other people may have pioneered it separately or before, and certainly the Chinese were doing their own thing for much longer. But in according to the Western world, the Greeks were the first ones who wrote anything down. And philosophy is just thinking really deeply about all of life, our life, our physical bodies, our internal experiences, and the external world that we see around us. It's not something that we can prove, but we can observe over and over and over, and we can create theories about why people do what they do, why bodies do what they do, why we have pain and anguish. So this is, in a broad way, philosophy. And forgive me if you're like, yes, 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 Sarah, we know what philosophy is. But it's not, it's something that we may take for granted. But in the ancient world, this was brand new and sparkly. And so Greek philosophy had already made it to Palestine. And Greek philosophy had already kind of filtered down into even the peasants and how the peasants thought. And certainly Jesus, who was a man of very deep thoughts, some of how he taught was agrarian, you know, to farmers and fishermen. Some of how he taught was very, very Jewish, using Jewish metaphors and Jewish symbolism and Jewish cultural nuances. And some of how he taught was shockingly Greek. And so that's another thing to think about. And what saying 29 is playing with is this dichotomy of body and spirit. And you could think of it as body versus soul. Now, the Greeks had very strong opinions about this. And it didn't matter what philosopher you favored in the Greco-Roman world. They all had very strong opinions, and almost every single philosopher favored the spirit, or if you like, the soul, over the body. Some of them went way far on that idea to say that the body is nothing and the spirit is everything. Some of them were a little milder. They're like, you know, the spirit's where it's at, but the body's not so bad. It's not so bad. It's not as good as the spirit, but you know, it's got its good points. Don't get so down on the body. But each one looked at them as separate things. Not this more modern, holistic, and actually it's also a very Chinese idea that the body, mind, spirit is connected and whole and three parts of one thing. That is a more modern idea in the West. That does not come from the Greeks. So we've got that going on. And if we look at all of this and realize that the Hebrew version of things exalted the body to at least the same place as the spirit, that the spirit came from God, and we've got images of the breath of God, the ruach, the breath of God that he blew on creation. We've got the spirit of the indwelling God. You know, these are not only and entirely Hebrew concepts, but they're very popular in the Hebrew mindset. And they would have been popular in Jesus's time. That would have been just something that, you know, everybody knew that, you know, God manifested in this spirit, wind, fire form, whenever the heck he liked. So it seems like Jesus is saying, it's a marvel that because of Ruach, the breath of God, the spirit, bodies came into existence. That's a marvel. And it seems like he's talking about creation there, you know, that first time when the body came out of the breath. And he says, and marvel of marvels, that you can get bodies from bodies, you know, that parents can have children. It's a marvel, it's a beauty, it's a wonder. But riddle me this, Batman, he seems to say. Riddle me this, how is it? And here he gets very, very Greek for a brief moment, or he seems to. How is it that this being, the thing that is, and what he's talking about, we're going to put this aside on the shelf and talk about this in just a second, inhabits this nothingness. And so he's going way farther than even some of the Greeks do. He's calling the body, the physical frame, nothing. It's nothing. Even as marvelous as it is that God created it, even as marvelous as it is that parents can have children, and look, there's more of them. When you look at the life that is connected to God, the being that is, the body is nothing in compared to it. And you have this image of this great wealth put inside this poverty. And the great wealth would be that internal spirit that is connected with the one God, put inside this, as Yoda would call it, this crude matter. In that way, he seems to say, yes, creation is wonderful and amazing and beautiful. And look, parents having children is a marvel of marvels. How do we do that? No one knows. But riddle me this. The strangest thing of all is that the beauty of our souls could be housed in the corruption of our bodies. And anyone who has to deal with chronic pain or growing old or the body beginning to fail on them or is on their deathbed and thinking, I thought there would be more than this, might be able to understand what he was saying there. It's not a teaching for teenagers. It's not a teaching for people who are in their prime, certain they are immortal, and that their bodies will never fail them and never die, and their knees will never need to be replaced, and their hips will never break spontaneously, causing them to fall. And they will never suffer from osteoporosis or lower back pain or chronic pain or fill in the blank. They will never have to have cataract surgery. And if you perhaps have a bit of a list of your own that you could fill in the blanks there, you may have had one or two moments thinking, really, God? Really? This is the body you've given me? What am I supposed to do with this? Thoughts. There's lots of different levels to think about there. What are you thinking?
Exactly what you were saying about the aging of the body and the physical corruptness of the body, living within, encompassing however we want to think about where our spirit is in us. Without the spirit, we have nothing. So if we don't believe that we have a soul, We are nothing.
Okay. Donna, you were grinning a moment ago. Would you like to add something?
Just lots of thoughts are going through my head. I guess I'm connected now.
You are connected.
It took me a few go rounds, but I got it. And maybe this is already said. What about the creation story in Genesis that God created man out of clay, out of a lump of clay, and the body appeared? I don't recall about spirit in that passage, but.
Well, first of all, remember that there's not one creation story. There are two.
Oh, okay. The one I remember is about the lump of clay.
So. Yeah. There are two creation stories in Genesis. And unlike some places where two different stories have been woven together, so you get a verse of one and a verse of the other, you see that in the Noah's Ark story. There's at least two different versions in there. In the creation story, you get one story and then the other story. So you don't get them interwoven. You get one and then you get the other. And so let me pull out my Bible. And if you've got one nearby, feel free. If you don't, I won't judge you.
Okay.
So we're looking at Genesis 1, 1.
I'm one.
Pardon me as I take a moment here.
That would be it.
Okay. So Genesis 1, 1
is
in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep. While a wind from God, that would be the breath of God, the ruach, swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. Boom. And God separated the light from the darkness. Called the light day, called the darkness night. And there was evening and there was morning the first day. Now I'm not going to read the whole thing. But right there, we've got the first creation story set up. This is where God creates in 6 days. And then on the seventh, he rests. That's the first creation story. And it is a cosmic creation story. It is where you step back and get the long view of God creating everything. This is not the creation story of a hands-on God. This is a creation story of the executive version of God. So if you fast forward to Genesis chapter 2, starting in the middle of the fourth verse, because what the heck, Jerome, we get another account of creation. Now, in the God created everything that there is in 6 days and rested on the seventh, we don't get the story of Adam and Eve. We don't get that story. The story of Adam and Eve comes from the second story of creation that starts in the second chapter of Genesis. Okay. So in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, when no plant in the field was yet on the earth and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no one to till the ground, but a stream would rise from the earth and the water the whole face of the ground. And the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground. And here you've got your clay. Here's your clay version.
There's the clay version.
There's a clay version.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And breathed into his nostrils. And so we still get the breath of God. Okay. Before it was the breath of God blowing over the earth. This time it is the breath of God blowing into his creation, the person. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east. And he put the man, whom he had formed, out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight. And so we see here the second telling of the story of creation, and it's very intimate. It is very up close. This is the God who rolls up his sleeves and is like, all right, let's play with clay. going to make a person, going to breathe life into him, going to make a beautiful garden, going to make all sorts of things to fill the garden. Oh, but the man is sad. Okay, not a problem. Going to make him a companion. Going to make him a giraffe. Going to make him a rhinoceros. Going to make him a lion. Going to make him a baby rabbit. Nothing satisfies this man. Okay, fine. I'm going to put him into a sleep. I'm going to take a rib from him. From that rib, I'm going to also, you know, take some dirt, and I'm going to fashion him a companion. And I'm going to breathe into his companion, and I'm going to give him his companion, and he's going to say, wowza, I'll take her. Mm-hmm. And so we have the second story of creation, and it's very hands-on. It's very up close and personal. This is not a cosmic God who creates in 6 days. This is the God that is as close as breathing into you, giving you CPR.
And is that what you're saying? The breathing of God into Adam and Eve is equivalent to providing them with spirit.
That is what most biblical scholars believe. And most theologians, they look at both accounts and they say, okay, in the beginning, there was a formless void. There was a wild, watery nothingness.
Right.
And God blew into it and from chaos created order. Mm-hmm. And that was God's spirit creating order out of chaos. And then in the intimate version, absolutely. God blew into his nostrils, and it's the same word in Hebrew, the ruach, the spirit, the blowing, the wind. In Hebrew, it means blowing, it means wind, it means spirit, it means soul, it means breath, it means inspiration. So it's the same word, and biblical scholars look at both of them and say, that is the animating spirit of God that is within us. And that is the animating spirit of God that turns chaos into order.
Okay. I guess the
Donna, why don't you go ahead and look at your camera while you speak?
Okay. Does it matter which came first?
The thing is,
but I'm, you know,
it's not meant to be chronological.
Well, isn't that what this reading is? They're saying that it's amazing. Jesus says the flesh.
Oh, came, I'm sorry. We're back to Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah. Jesus said if the flesh came into existence because of spirit, that's amazing. If spirit came into the existence because of the body, that's really amazing. But I'm amazed at how such great wealth has been placed in this poverty. I kind of get the idea that they're both amazing. And I guess the question I have is, does it matter which came first?
Or maybe that's, it does matter.
Maybe that's just too concrete. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, you know, I don't know that it does matter. And, you know, perhaps Jesus, and this is like another level of interpretation, perhaps Jesus is pointing out that, you know, creation is wonderful, but you know, these bodies are still not all that and a bag of chips. Like, have you noticed the bodies fail and they die?
Right. And in the intimate creation story, then God breathes life, breathes spirit, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. What other thoughts do you have? And remember, you don't have to agree with me, and you don't have to like this saying. That's okay. Yeah, Marilyn?
Okay.
In either story, it is God who has created the whole thing, spirit and body, whatever. What is there about a created creature like us that some people recognize that we are creatures of God and created by God, and other people that God, there is no God. God has nothing to do with it.
You know, I think that's probably a much deeper question.
I'm sorry?
And it's probably a much deeper question. And it probably has as many answers as there are people who choose not to believe that. I would point to the dreadful job that Christianity has made in convincing the world it is a benign force for good. Yes. That is what I would point to. But of course, there are undoubtedly other reasons. But it's, if you take the truth and you package it in pain and anguish, and then use it as an excuse to kill people, a very predictable thing happens. People don't want that truth. You can't make them want that truth because they don't want the packaging. They don't want a group of people claiming supremacy and justifying murderous and dreadful and inhumane acts. And it doesn't really matter to them if the group of people says, oh, I'm so sorry, afterwards. I'm so sorry, I was wrong. Well, that's nice. We're still going to be over here. Leave us alone. And that is the unfortunate and often repeated history of Christianity. Now, has Christianity done heaps of wonderful things? Absolutely. I mean, we have Jesus as our head, and he was amazing. He was, objectively speaking, whether or not you want to honor him as the Son of God, he was, objectively speaking, amazing. He was a wonder worker who healed people and taught people how to love their neighbors as themselves. And he exorcised demons, and he raised people from the dead. And he got mad at people when they were being corrupt and abusing others. Like, objectively speaking, Jesus was awesome. But I know a lot of people who cannot stand to hear about Jesus because his followers have hurt them so badly. And they have a real good point, I think. And it's a real shame because it's already happened. And I'm not entirely sure that we can convince those people. God may be able to convince those people, but I'm not sure that we can.
Even God will have a tough time if we don't clean up our act.
Well,
you have a challenging time.
Yeah.
Also move great distances from superstition and mysticism into science, factual things. That's a huge item as well, I think, in the, mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to convince someone who is well steeped in the scientific method that this creation happened, not the Big Bang, which they really don't understand anyways, not really, but they're searching for a different beginning, and mm-hmm. And maybe it was God who created the Big Bang, who knows, and you know, and it's, I think that's is also a huge part of the pulling away from it's. In their minds, I think it's uneducated or anti-intellectual to believe in a kind of thing.
Exactly. And while the church...
I agree with your observation as well. We've not done a great job.
While the church in the 1200s did embrace the resurgence of Greek thought when it was rediscovered in the 1100s and the 1200s, and the church did embrace rationality, mm-hmm. as opposed to only biblical authority. And that happened in the 1200s, and it was a worldwide phenomenon across the West. It wasn't just Christian scholars, it was Jewish scholars, and it was Islamic scholars, because the works of Plato and Aristotle had been translated into Latin and into Arabic. Mm-hmm. And they were disseminated, and they changed everything. And so far as I can tell from my historical reading, that was the one time that the church was absolutely on board, on the cutting edge, and saying, oh, yeah, we can use rational thought to help us understand God, to help us live a holy life, to help us follow God's will. And God bless them, they got that right. Anselm of Canterbury, he led the charge, and it was wonderful. So actually, it was the one before him, Lanfranc. But anyway, moving on. But here's the thing. To the best of my knowledge, that was the only time that the church was on the cutting edge of integrating our belief structure, our theology, our philosophy, and how we live our lives according to God's will. Integrating that with, pardon me, let's call it cutting edge notions about what is true about the world. Now, I have my own personal reasons as to why that is, because I think that you can't unsee a logical proof. Like, once you have been introduced to the concept of if A, then B, and if B, then C, then A equals C, like, you can't unsee that idea.
Right.
Because it just makes so much sense. Mm. That logical progression of thought. But when Galileo supposed that the earth was not the center of the universe, we know what happened to him. And so that was the last time that the church was on the cutting edge. Now, the church is several hundred years behind science. And the thing is, the church catches up and the church agrees. Oh, actually, yeah, God is in that. And God is in that, and God is in that. And we no longer feel threatened. And we can just say with happiness in our hearts, God is in that too. And I was raised as conservative as my church and my parents were. I was raised by a scientist who was also a mystic. Riddle me that, Batman. And so I got this fusion of creation absolutely exists, creation is real, and the Big Bang is real. And creation is how an ancient people tried to describe the Big Bang Theory. Not that they understood the Big Bang Theory, because they were not scientific. But creation is how they did their very best to describe a God who was responsible for everything.
Christianity embraces evolution. The Catholic Church has it in writing in their fundamental beliefs, their creed, that they support the concept and embrace the concept of evolution. So, mm-hmm. That's one example. And there are a lot of books about how science and Christianity fit together. There are a lot of books on that.
Exactly right. And the only problem, perhaps, it's not the only problem, is that Christianity, and here I'm talking, let's say the major three, Orthodox Christianity, not that there's just one Orthodox church, there are many, many, many different Orthodox churches, Roman Catholic Christianity, and there's just the one Roman Catholic church, and Protestant Christianity. And again, like the Orthodox, there's not just one Protestant church, there's many, many, many Protestant churches. But what you didn't see in the beginning of, you know, the Enlightenment, you didn't see in the 1700s and in the 1600s, you didn't see in the 1800s with the advent of psychology, you didn't see the church being the first one on the bandwagon, you know, the first one to say, you know, Newton's got a point. Even though in England, at least, so many natural philosophers, which, you know, the precursor to scientists, were actually country rectors. They were priests in parishes that didn't have a lot of demands on their time. Like, they had to do a Sunday service. They had to do one or two services every day. They had to do a little visiting to sick parishioners, and they didn't have to do anything else because the parish just ran itself. So what they did, how they spent their time, was beginning science in the UK. And so there is an irony there that the church incidentally supported so much scientific research at the very cutting edge, and yet the hierarchy of the church was in such profound disagreement, I would say because it felt threatened, that, oh, you know, science is going to replace God, which, you know, a lot of Christians think is kind of silly talk right now, but that was the fear hundreds of years ago. And then for some people, science did replace God, because the church, I would argue, wasn't doing its job. They weren't actually living out fully and completely anything that Christ told us to do. And it's just a difficult and ugly and dreadful situation. And Marilyn, that is essentially my answer to your question. It's not a simple answer.
The church is people.
And one of the things that
have great flaws.
The church is people, Donna. The church is people. Marilyn, what were you going to say?
I keep going back to that thing you said, a lot of people don't believe because Christians have caused them pain. And, but it just made me think of something else. It may or may not be relevant, but physical pain, yeah, I'll buy that, okay. But mental pain, I think, is often caused not by the person who supposedly is giving it, but because of the way we interpret what they have done. And I think we bring a lot of pain on ourselves because we misinterpret what somebody else has said, perhaps.
I'm going to disagree with you in part, Marilyn, because when we are adults, we've got our whole basket of coping strategies and skills and life experiences. I could be gently okay with that idea. But when we are children, we do not have any of those skills. We do not have any of those coping strategies. And I would not want it to be thought that children cannot be caused pain by their parents, by older siblings, and by any adult in their sphere, because it is the parents and adults and older children in their sphere, it is their responsibility to literally define what is true and real and normal to the children. And what you see in households where there is some measure of abuse and neglect, whether it's a little bit, just occasionally, just maybe just that one time, or whether it's frequent and egregious, what you see is literally defenseless children. And before the age of about 7, children are defenseless. Literally defenseless children being caused pain by the people who are supposed to love them. Now, I will take off my social worker hat because it is true that adults have much more capacity to choose. But even teenagers, you know, past the point of 7 years old, don't always have the capacity to choose. They're literally not wired for it in their brains yet. And so the church, through its members, and I'm not just talking about clergy abuse, though certainly there is that, but I'm talking about parents who espouse the ideas of religion and literally hurting their children with them. And I speak as someone who married into an atheist family. Wasn't I a surprise when I was brought home for dinner? But both of my husband's parents were raised in the Roman Catholic Church. And they're both atheists now. Mm-hmm. My father-in-law, raging, flaming atheist. My mother-in-law, meh, less so. She comes to church every now and again to hear my sermons when she's in town. My husband was raised as an atheist in this atmosphere. Now, his teenage rebellion was to find spirituality because teenagers rebel. And whatever it is espoused by their parents, they will seek the opposite just to spite them. And it's a totally natural, normal thing. And he found essentially Buddhist spirituality and Buddhist thought, which prepared him well for marriage with me. He loves Jesus. He follows Jesus. He refuses to be baptized, though his crazy aunt may have secretly baptized him, but putting that aside. And it's a hair he is determined to split, and I support him in that. Because seeped in that atheist world and raised by parents who were so profoundly hurt by the Roman Catholic Church through their own parents, to be clear, he cannot side with the church. He will take his stand with God and with Jesus, but he will not side with the church. Mm-hmm. Is that everyone's experience? No, of course not. But it definitely was their experience. And it can be a hard thing for faithful Christians who have lived a peaceful life, trying desperately to love their neighbor as themselves. It can be a hard truth to swallow to hear that someone else's experience has been so profoundly different and so hurtful.
I have 2 out of 4 kids that are like your husband. It's hard on both sides.
It is. Jeanette, what were you going to say?
I said, shall we move on to number 30?
I think that's a great idea. Jeanette, do you want to read it for us?
Yeah. It's pretty short. Sure. Jesus said, where there are two or one, I am with them.
Okay. For anyone
different from everybody else's, but
that's okay. For anyone who couldn't hear everything Jeanette said, Yeshua said, where there are three gods, they are gods. Where there are two or one, I am with them. And now I invite you to a moment or two of silence as we think about that. What do you make of this saying?
Doesn't make any sense at all.
Okay, that's fair. Anybody else want to weigh in?
No, I had the same reaction, Jeanette. It didn't make much sense to me, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
If there are three, they're divine. But there are two, then I am with them. Why wouldn't you be with the three that are divine as well?
Also, how can there be more than one God? I mean, he's saying if there were three or two, fine. Right. But there's only one God.
Well,
my thing, yeah, deities.
For one thing, we're told that if we believe in Jesus and we believe in God, we are inheritors of heaven through him, and therefore we are children of God, which makes us gods. So that was how I interpreted that first part. But then also, we're, what is it, two or more? I thought it was three or more are gathered together. I am with you. So that second part confuses me.
Mm-hmm. So you're quoting from the Gospel of Matthew, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, I am with them.
But wait a minute. Those are people. Those are not gods in that chapter of Matthew.
Right.
He was talking about people, not gods. This verse of Thomas, he was talking about gods. Makes no sense.
Well, let's pause for a second and recognize that, okay, Matthew has a different version of the saying. It's not exactly the same, but it is extremely reminiscent. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is the last part, where there are two or one, I am with them. Now, is he talking people? Is he talking God's little g? Is he talking deities in a way we don't understand? Is he challenging that there might be more than one God? I'm going to take a stab and say he's probably not challenging that there's more than one God, because this is Jesus. So it probably means something else. So Jesus is the last one who will challenge the idea that God, whom he calls Father, is split somehow, or that other things that are lesser than God, whom he calls Father, could be equated with God, whom he calls Father. Okay, we could put a pin in that, which means it's still confusing.
Because it's the one, God doesn't recognize three because of the oneness of creation. You know, Father, Son, right. Holy Spirit, all one.
Right. So that's another good element to think about this in here. So we've got the Trinity, which is also, let us be super clear, confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can understand it to a certain degree, and then the rest is, it's mystery. Okay. So
maybe Thomas didn't get it right.
Right. That's always a good point. That is always a good point.
This is secondhand.
Right. Just as with the regular Gospels, the ones that we have actually in our Bibles.
Right.
We always got to take it with a grain of salt. Because it's not just like the Gospel of Thomas is meant to be secondhand. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are third hand at best. Because they were written by the students of Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, likely on their deathbeds or just afterwards. And so it's the students remembering their teacher's story of his teacher.
Okay.
And so that's third hand. Okay. So Sue's possible interpretation, which I think is a very interesting and compelling one, is, okay, so let's use our logical brains on this one. God the Father has God the Son, who's Jesus. And God the Son has assured us in more than one place in the Gospels that we are his brothers, his sisters, and that we are inheritors with him and through him to God the Father. And that when he dies, he goes to prepare a place for us in the mansion of God the Father, because we belong there. We are children of God. Now, few of us have managed to get to the point of such complete oneness that Jesus obviously experienced with God the Father, that we could say, yep, I'm as good as Jesus. I'm there. I've made it. Hello, my name is Sarah and I'm enlightened. No, no. Maybe some of the saints, maybe not. But Jesus has promised us that we could, in fact, in theory, do even more than he could do, because we're going to last longer. We are simply going to be on this earth longer than he. And so it sets this up to say, okay, you're a child of God. I'm a child of God. Does that not make us gods? All right. I'm willing to go down that philosophical rabbit hole, that logical rabbit hole. The tricky thing about going down that philosophical rabbit hole is that if we're still in a place where we don't experience oneness with God all the time like Jesus did, then we're still very strongly influenced by the devil. And the devil loves to take the powerful and make them do rather foolish things. Perhaps you've noticed. And the story of Christianity abusing the trust of the people around it is the story of people, human beings, who have power and lord it over others, just like Jesus told us not to do. And so going down the rabbit hole of saying, Jeanette, you are a child of God, therefore you are God. And Grace, you are a child of God, therefore you are God. And Cerise, you are a child of God, therefore you are God. And Donna and Sue and Marilyn, you are children of God, therefore you are God. The problem with that is we still don't make decisions like Jesus made decisions. And we don't love people like Jesus loved people. And we are not, in fact, very reliable. And so, Sue, on the one hand, I say yes, and on the other hand, I say no. And that is my final answer.
And I say it's partly the capital G and the lowercase g. Mm-hmm. We don't come close.
We might one day if we work on it, but not now.
Yeah, I think the lowercase g's just, you know, they're in the growing pattern.
Mm-hmm. And so then, if we take that as an idea, okay, so the little case G, they're in the growing pattern, they're getting there, they're working on it. Okay, if there are three of them together, then they're going to make better decisions. They're going to be a check and balance on each other. If there are one or two, I'll go with them. I'll be their check and balance. I'll help.
There are three there without God. What does that mean then?
Well, that's a good question, because you could take it in reverse. Instead of looking at it as a positive, which he stated it in the positive, you could look at it in the negative. So if you're three, you don't get Jesus. That doesn't sound like fun. I'd boot the third. I want Jesus. Better to go it alone and have Jesus than those two other schmucks.
And another question that went with the previous reading, but then we switched over. But there are a lot of, probably a lot of people in this world. We think they have a mental problem, but people who don't really like themselves and respect themselves, and we're always saying, oh, you have to think highly of yourself in order to care about other people too. But if you don't think much of yourself, then how do you love others as you love yourself?
That is a beautiful question. And it's one that should encourage us to love ourselves better and better and better, even if we think we're doing a good job. Because let me tell you, a lot of people with very low self-esteem, they think they're fine. Because it's normal. Because it's what they've always known. And human beings tend to keep on doing what they've always done, so long as it works well enough. I mean, have you noticed that we don't seem to like change? I mean, the best of us aren't like huge fans of change. But it's certainly a problem, because if you get people who are loving others as much as they're capable of loving themselves, and they're not capable of loving themselves very well, you could argue that the system starts to break down. Or you could argue that if we are constantly every day loving ourselves a little bit better than we did yesterday, just a tiny fraction, then there is nowhere to go but up. And it will at least be an upward spiral instead of a downward spiral.
I suppose a lot of it depends on your definition of love and how it's expressed.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And now, friends, it is 11. And this explains why we only do so many in an hour. Sorry. Thank you very much for coming. I will see you next week.
Thank you.
Therese, it was great to see you.
Yep. Thank you. Good to see everybody.
Bye.
Looking forward to it.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye.